Kamenetsky Brothers Podcast, Brian Kamenetsky, Andy Kamenetsky, co-host of the Lando Lakers blog. I think it's fair to say, Andy, one of the more compelling stories of last year dealt with Royce White, drafted 16th by the Rockets, but never actually suited up to play for him.
Yeah, there have been a lot of concerns, Brian, about White heading into the draft, that his very public acknowledged battle with general anxiety disorder would lead to issues fitting in with the team culture, whether you're talking travel, dealing with a medical staff, that sort of thing. The Rockets and White were unfortunately never able to really find common ground, and he spent most of the season really estranged from the team before eventually getting traded in the offseason to the Sixers. He still, though, remains a very outspoken advocate for mental health issues.
Right, and certainly the question of mental health and people with mental health issues and how they function in an organization like the NBA is an open question. Both White and the Sixers are hopeful that he'll be able to make his NBA debut this year. We had a chance to speak with White earlier Monday afternoon, started off by asking him to describe exactly what it is that he deals with. He talked about his anxiety disorder, but also some of the other symptoms that he has that impact his daily life.
I also deal with OCD, PTSD, hypervigilance, which is like kind of like a sub illness or like an illness that comes up from having anxiety or PTSD or OCD. Hypervigilance is really just like a heightened sense of awareness of, you know, external and internal bodily functions. You know, it's really just heightens your senses, and it kind of puts you on like a high alert subconsciously. Because of your anxiety or because of your PTSD, and you're just scanning for threats, constantly scanning for threats. And, you know, I also obviously deal with the phobia of flying. And all five are, like, really separate. But some of them have the same symptoms, and some of them have very, very real physical symptoms. And I just try to do my best to learn up on all of the things that I deal with and put myself in a situation where I don't let anything become overwhelming.
On a day-to-day level, how much is this a battle for you in terms of trying to keep it all in check so you feel like you can function to the best of your ability?
Well, I mean, I'm fortunate, right, because I've been advocating for mental health since I was in college, and I have a number of doctor friends now that I can call to whenever I'm feeling like it, I'm having trouble coping myself with the things I deal with. So I do well. But I think anybody who knows the real dynamic or the real risk that you run of having a mental illness and being a high risk for a very unhealthy type of thing understands that it's risky, and that makes the battle 100% hard every day, because, you know, it's a life thing. You know, it's your life that's at stake, because, as we know, stress is one of the number one killers of human beings.
And you know, obviously, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think this is where some of the misperceptions come from, like in terms of things like flying. It's not that you can't get on an airplane, have never been on an airplane, won't get on an airplane. But can you explain how, with something like flying, which is so integral to the NBA lifestyle, why that is a problem?
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, again, people are underestimating, and it's just like a society thing. And humans are underestimating just how dangerous stress is, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's something we really take for granted, is like, you know, just allowing ourselves to be stressed out, and we kind of taught ourselves that life is supposed to be stressful and just to deal with it. You know, it just so happens to me that my phobia of flying creates a situation where, you know, the stress becomes real physical real quick. And what I mean by that is, like, the physical symptoms are present right away, you know, so it's not like the stress and the hardened arteries and 30 years from now I have a heart attack because I didn't watch my stress levels. It's like I'm fatigued right there on the spot and sweating, you know what I mean? So, and that's something that you wouldn't want to have to deal with 100 times, which is like the standard NBA schedule in terms of flights. If we could cut it down to 15 or 10 or 20, that would be ideal, and that's what we worked for last year.
So, yeah, it's talking about last year. Where do you think things sort of fundamentally broke down last year with the Rockets as you were trying to come up with an arrangement that worked for everyone?
I don't think it really broke down. I think what happened was, you have a league that's been doing things a certain way for a long time, and a player that came in and asked and suggested some things that hadn't really been touched on in terms of not only just like day-to-day operation, but in terms of our collective bargaining agreement and the whole landscape, and the industry itself and how the industry itself has tackled mental health or dealt with it in the past, which they admittedly said that, they haven't that much. We haven't really dealt with a situation like this, nor do we have anything on the books in terms of protocol on how to deal with this. So that made it even harder to just say, okay, this is how we should solve it, because we had to be patient with even how to solve the issue, because, there's precedents and things that a corporation has to pay attention to before they just start to handle a player a certain way.
And in the meantime, you guys are working sort of in real time without a blueprint, which I'm sure makes the whole thing
right.
More confusing.
That was the huge thing. And that's why, for me, it got frustrating to see the fans just, really take for granted the process and not understand the process. And you got fans that would say, oh, the Rockets aren't doing the right thing, or the NBA is, and then you got the fans to say, oh, Royce is, being a crybaby. But, reality is, as we all know, is, progress happens through conversation. Like, and you can't rush it, because when you rush it, you don't get it right. And like you said, we didn't have any blueprint to go off of. I mean, there literally is no protocol on how to deal with mental health in terms of punishment, rule breaking. If there's, let's say I'm riding my bus and there's a snowstorm and I miss shoot around, do I get fined like the player who overslept and, just didn't make the bus? So there was all kinds of things that we had to go and talk about and discuss in terms of, dotting our I's and crossing our T's.
You mentioned fan impression, Royce, and some fans feeling like you were either being a baby about it or a diva or whatever. With that in mind, do you think that the problem was exacerbated at all by how much you were talking about it on Twitter, which is it's a great form of communication in certain ways, but 140 characters and fewer can be limiting in terms of explaining something this complicated.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, it was for sure an exacerbator, me taking to Twitter. But again, I feel like it was a situation that needed to be exacerbated because, dealing with it in real time and understanding the negotiations that were going on and the leverage that was being used on both sides, it's a business. It's all about leverage. I felt like I needed to take to and just try and get people to understand what I was saying. And maybe if I did it in a public forum that, we would be able to unify the message. But that didn't happen as we planned, so to speak. I mean, it did, because in a way we're in a place now that's greater than we were 6 months ago with it. But like I said, I mean, it's something that I didn't really worry about, the message or who understood what, because the people who were looking for the right things heard the right things. And so when I talk about unifying the message, I'm not talking about your average NBA fan. I'm talking about people like nonprofit organizations who then started to pick up on what was going on and started to support and lended their support in how to building a plan or a type of prototype or protocol that could help us navigate the situation. And that's why I took to Twitter. It wasn't for the average fan just to inform them of something that they probably would never understand anyway or really care to understand. So
how sensitive are you to the idea that what you do and how your career ultimately turns out and the ways that accommodations are or are not made for you makes things either easier or harder for any other players that come behind you with similar types of mental illness that may need accommodation as well?
Yeah, well, the reality is that players will only get the support they need in terms of what we know in the mental health community to be the needed support, right? The necessary support. There's always a difference between what you're willing to do and what's necessary. Mm-hmm. And in terms of what's necessary from what we know in the mental health community, the NBA will have to decide whether they're going to provide that for its players or not. And that can only come from them. And if my actions it stop them, you know, let's just talk about what we're really talking about here. If the next owner says, you know, we're not going to draft a guy with anxiety disorder because of the Roy situation. Well, A, that's illegal. You can't not draft somebody because of a disability. So that's out the window. That's not going to happen. But let's say, you know, they don't want to provide the support that's necessary, those type of things. That will only hurt them, you know. And that's what I try to get them to see is that we're in a business. We're not making water bottles here, right? We're not making T-shirts. There's no printing machines. You're using human beings as commodities. And human beings, you have to be responsible for everything that humans deal with. And obviously, mental health is a huge piece, right? There is no health without mental health. So if they don't make a decision to be responsible for that, then, you know, the players will never get what they need anyway. And it really doesn't even matter what I do. But, you know, it's my obligation to try and advocate for myself in real time.
What's interesting though is, I mean, an owner will never say though, this guy, we're not touching him because he's got an anxiety disorder, and we all saw what happened with Royce White. They'll just find a different reason not to draft him. You know, they'll you know, he doesn't have the right, his jumper's not good enough or something like that. So.
Right, right.
We have too many at the same position, doesn't fit system, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, and, well, I think that, you know, the reality of the situation is that the NBA is a league of 350 players, and if they choose to discriminate against players with mental health disorders, they'll only be putting a little stop to the problem, right? And meanwhile, they're bleeding internally. Because the reality is there's players in the league that deal with mental health issues, and there's players that will not be as open as I was about my anxiety, and they'll just never tell anybody about their mental health issues in order to pass the draft process. And then they'll end up having to deal with it anyway because, you know, when you have to hide it, that makes it worse, as we all know. So,
Royce, you've said some really interesting things in other interviews about the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, and I know you know more about it than I do, and I certainly don't want to get, you know, too deep into it. But there's a lot of talk in it about reasonable accommodations and essential functions of a job and things like that. When you look at those things, because it is a very interesting way to look at, you know, your employment in the NBA, what do you consider to be reasonable accommodations, and what are the essential functions of an NBA job?
Well, I mean, I think when you talk about essential functions of a job, I mean, if we put it in terms of what you have to be able to do in an athletic type of job. You know, can you run, you know, is your body equipped? You know, can you pass your physical to even play? Right. Is your heart okay? You know what I mean? And, you know, can you physically go in the job and do what's required? You know, in terms of how to get to the job. So, you know, you have to break it down in parts, in terms of ADA. It's like, the job site itself is actually once you get to the court. Right. And how do you get to work, you know, is really the plane ride that we're talking about. You know, and how you get to work is obviously something that can be, you know, changed or you know, alternated, which is what we did in letting me drive a bus to the games. And I mean, I think it's reasonable. And to be fair, the NBA never said that it wasn't reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
So they were really good with that. And the Rockets said, you know, that's reasonable as well, which is why when I went down to the D League in the middle of last season, they provided a bus for me for every road trip, and it worked out good. I mean, I really like the road, and it's fun for me, and they didn't have a problem with it. So, you know,
do you feel like, Royce, there's going to come a point where, I guess, getting the ball rolling will require you at some level to, I guess, step into some discomfort? Because it sounds like, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it's difficult to imagine a scenario where everything is laid out where you're going to be entirely comfortable from the outset. And it seems like there's going to be a point where you just have to kind of jump into the unknown in order to really, I guess, get some momentum in terms of your career.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that, again, there's a huge difference in what we think and just your everyday, you know, average person dealing with life. And then what the mental health community knows and what the health community knows is, you know, we do things every day that aren't healthy for us, right? And we know it, and we just continue to do it anyway. It's just the lay of the land. But there's a big difference in between discomfort and high risk of being exposed to too much stress. You know, there's a huge difference in that when you're talking medically right yeah. now. And you know what I mean? So, you know, I think that you have to look at that and say, okay, well, you know, of course I'm going to, you know, have some discomfort. And I've already accepted that that will happen, which is why I said I'll fly when I have to, like on a back-to-back from New York to L.A., right? So, I mean, I think that's okay. And the discomfort is going to come. But there's just a huge difference between discomfort and high risk of too much exposure or high risk of stress.
You did an interview with Grantland the day of the draft, and they followed you around in documentary form, and you were very adamant about proving that somebody dealing with these different anxieties and disorders that you are could make an NBA career doable, and that you wanted to prove doubters wrong. Is this still as high a priority, just that concept to you, or has it grown into something, I guess, bigger for you, that, you know, whether or not you actually prove that, like the idea of making awareness of what you're going through more important than actually proving that maybe you could jam a square peg into a round hole?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that it's all about how you perceive what I said, you know, and
right.
and saying that I want to prove that you could make it with an anxiety disorder at some point in time that may require you to advocate for yourself, which is what I've done. You know, that's part of it. And I'm doing a great job of it. I mean, you know, the honest truth is that by now, based on the things that I've said and done, I could have already been out of the league, but I'm not. And regardless of what that says about me or the people that work for me or the NBA or the Rockets, whoever, the reality is that I'm still here, haven't had been honest about my disorder, and I am and doing as best a job as I can, or at least attempting to advocate for myself in an honest way, which is what I think is most important for players going into the league or going into anything, any professional league or any job, in terms of can they make it? So when I say, you know, could you make it with a disorder, that doesn't necessarily mean, you know, me go out and win Rookie of the Year. Right?
Sure.
That's not what I was actually saying. I was just saying, can I even survive in the league, right, with that being honest? Because like we said, the stigma is out there. The awareness is low. The resources are low. The support is low. I just went to NAMI and heard a full day's conversation about how the insurance companies don't have equality between mental health and physical health, and the NBA doesn't escape having to deal with insurance companies. So you see what I mean? There's more to it than just going out and being successful on the court. And I think me advocating for myself was one of the most important things for me to do.
Russ, got one more question for you, kind of about this, the mental health issues and your in your situation particularly, and we want to get into your game and some other things as well. Among the other things that seem to have been a sticking point is this idea of having an independent physician that you can go to that can kind of monitor whether or not you need, you know, there are certain nights where maybe you aren't mentally able to play, you know, that you're as like some guy might have a knee injury that would keep him off the court or things like that. Can you explain how that process is important and how that might work? And, you know,
I think one of the things that happened with the real sports segment was the context was lost. And obviously, that happens. You know, that's just regular from cutting and editing. Mm-hmm. We all know that. But the context of the physician only came to that. I mean, that's the most dramatic, you know, case scenario is them saying, okay, he can't play tonight. That's not what we really asked for. We asked for, when I say we, I mean me and my doctor and some more people in the medical world that we grouped together to try and figure out how to work this thing out. And we said that we wanted a neutral medical person that would keep the interest solely in health, you know, because, again, you got to a player commodity league, right? And obviously, anytime you have commodities, human being commodities, their health is never going to be the number one priority. And that's just the reality. And that can be dangerous in terms of mental health, because, again, when you talk about mental health or mental health that goes unsupported, the risks are way, way different than a broken toe or a broken leg. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's what we ask for, is that in all things, all daily operations, that we're consulting somebody who is trained and familiar with not only mental health, but the dynamic that it plays on people's day-to-day lives and how to cope with that and how to support it and how to treat it. So it really, we really ask for like more of a third-party consultant. Now, am I saying that it would never happen that, let's say I use an example a lot when I'm talking to GMs and people like, in the league and the players union and trying to figure this thing out is, you know, let's say I'm on my way to the game down in Houston, for example, where I was, and I get in a car accident, right? And let's say I'm not injured. I mean, let's say I'm physically not, you know, nothing happened. I got a scratch, you know what I mean? But let's say it sends me into a panic attack. Right. Okay. Well, the panic attack, as people in the mental health community know, has very real physical symptoms. Right. It's not just, oh, you're freaking out in your head. You get the sweat, dehydration, hard to focus. Right. So at that point, you would need somebody, as to where somebody who's not trained in mental health may say, oh, you're okay to go play. Somebody who is trained would probably say, well, that really doesn't make great sense. So that's, you know, those are the complicated conversations that we had to have and we're still having, because, you know, it's necessary, and it's all. I think it's doable, it's solvable, but it's definitely complex.
And because the NBA has very strict rules, and teams have rules about doctors and who you see and who you don't. But it's not necessarily a question of you know, Royce White wants a guy before every game to sign off on what he's doing. You're looking for an awareness of
exactly
situations that may come up that are different than normal.
And the reason why we had to do that is because the first thing that I asked for was that the NBA raised their awareness, right? Okay, but you can't put your coaches and everybody through these mental health seminars. And I mean, you can, right? But that's a process. So basically what we were saying, and what my doctor, my family practitioner who diagnosed me in high school said was, it's unsafe, it's illogical, and it's very unhealthy for your general manager to be making decisions or making the final decision in terms of situations that have to do with mental health. It's not logical.
My last question for you, Royce, before shifting into basketball and some other things as well. You've talked about also beyond the anxiety disorder, dealing with OCD and hypervigilance. Do you ever have concerns of just becoming too consumed with the cause and just losing yourself in some of that messaging to your own detriment in terms of, you know, being aware of your own mental health?
Well, I mean, I think that's a tough question to answer. I mean, the reality is that the cause is not, it's become a cause, but that was done by the media, right? And it seems like this huge crusade, but it's really not. It's just the NBA really hasn't dealt with mental health yet. And in terms of their legislation or in terms of their groundwork in the corporation, we have to patch up that hole, because obviously mental health is a component that not only I deal with, but most of the players. And they can't make a rule for me without making it for the other players. That's how it's become a cause, because it can't be individual. But in terms of my, you know, advocacy for mental health awareness, that'll go to Capitol Hill, because that's what I do. I've been doing it since before I was in the NBA. So the cause isn't as big as people would think it is, in terms of mental health in the NBA and the battle to get them to understand. It's really just a necessary thing for them and for everybody. And I'll just continue to advocate, you know.
So then you consider what's going on between you and the NBA different than what you would do with Capitol Hill then?
Well, yeah, definitely. I mean, the NBA is a very unique profession, and the dynamic for its employees is a far different conversation. I mean, there's much more basic conversations that need to be happening in terms of supporting mental health nationwide, worldwide, that would happen way before we ever got to the type of conversation that me and the NBA are having. But we had to have that conversation because that's where I work.
Right.
So, you know what I mean? Is, you know, that when you talk about mental health, the basic things are stigma, awareness, resources, support, right? Those are like the four basic things. And here we're talking about more higher level, like human relations, human resource department type of things in terms of the NBA. So,
Royce, you were a guy that was described as a top five talent in the draft. And, you know, and obviously the mental health and the anxiety is one of the reasons that you fell down in the draft. But you didn't play. You didn't play in the NBA last year. Where do you like? What kind of player do you think you could be at this level? Because we still haven't seen it.
Well, I mean, I think I was considered a top five talent for a reason, and I don't think it was so much based on potential or upside, which a lot of the top five guys that are picked are based on nowadays. Is the potential and upside? I think I showed a lot of production, combined with a body type that. That obviously translates to the NBA. And I think, you know, the way that I play is just so, not, I don't want to say consistent because that may sound a little too, you know, toot my own horn, but it's a style of play that's just not going anywhere. It's not really dependent on too much of anything. You know what I mean? I'm just always looking to make the guys around me better, get guys open shots. I rebound and push, and I find that it's easier to get guys open shots when I rebound and push, because a lot of times the big men on other teams are trained to run back to the paint first, and I get to, you know, dribble up their back. So, you know, things like that aren't going anywhere. My ability to dribble at my size isn't going anywhere. My strength isn't going anywhere. So, you know, I think I'm still the same player that I was before the draft, basketball-wise.
I know you can't necessarily expect anything given, you know, the issues that we were talking about with before and everything you're trying to figure out, but if nothing else, do you anticipate taking the court for the Sixers?
Oh yeah. I think, you know, there's a great chance. I mean, I would say probably it's not there's a slim chance that I don't, just because it feels good at this point. I mean, this last year is the year that we took to have all the tough conversation. I think, like I said, we're in a way better place now. The union is aware that you know, there's some cracks in the CBA in terms of mental health that create, you know, some issues in terms of when teams and players get in conflicts about mental health, or when a player asks a team to, you know, support it in a certain way. Obviously, there's some rules that need to be written next time we do our CBA. But everybody understands that, and now it's like, okay, anything that comes up, we'll just have a discussion about right there because we can't rewrite the CBA yet. So I think this whole last year was exactly what we needed to do in order to say, okay, now going forward, now let's just go out and I'll play. And if something comes up that we need to discuss, we can have a discussion about it.
Shifting gears entirely, but when Brian and I have been reading up about you and preparing to talk, three names keep coming up in our research: Frank Sinatra, John Lennon, Prince. For you, what's the commonality between those guys? Because there are huge influences on you. You have a Frank Sinatra tattoo, for people who aren't aware. You grew out the beard as an homage to John Lennon. I guess sort of what speaks to you about those three guys, and is there a commonality for them?
Well, I think, you know, musicians and creators, artists, you know, all have a commonality. Really, I mean, they're all writers when you get back down to it. And, you know, that's the commonality. But for me, I mean, I took very different things from all three of those guys. Prince, me being from Minnesota, and Prince is just like an idol by default, right? he's just one of those guys that was gonna be an idol no matter what. And he's incredible. I mean, he's a musical genius for sure. And I really like that Prince was the kind of guy that wasn't afraid to be weird. He wasn't afraid to do things that nobody really thought, you know, make a lot of sense or looked that funny. And he just combated that with continuing to be innovative and be great music-wise. You know, Sinatra is just a class act. I mean, there's nobody smoother than Frank, obviously, and John is, was way ahead of his time, and he's almost a futurist in philosophy. You know, besides making great music, and obviously I'm a big fan of the Beatles, but John's philosophy and his outlook on life and his whole approach to life, that positivity and peace could be achieved, was something that most people should believe in, even though we don't.
So Prince still holds that shadow over Minnesota, because you grew up past what I think would be considered his heyday. Like, you know, when
he
was
just a tad bit past it.
Yeah.
But because I was a tad bit past it, you know, obviously my mother and my mom's friends, and, you know, he still had a very huge presence, you know, 10 years later after his heyday, so to speak, in terms of the music that was being played in your everyday car. So
like, your parents sat you down and like, son, it's time to introduce you to a little album called Purple Rain. Is that how it went?
Well, actually, the first time I heard Purple Rain was when I watched the movie, and he had another movie, Graffiti Bridge.
Sure.
And then I went back and grabbed my mom's Purple Rain and listened to it more in depth from a musical standpoint. And the crazy thing is that I wasn't so heavy into music until I was a little bit older. So now, going back and listening to Purple Rain, I have a whole different perspective on it. I have a whole different way that I take it in. And the Beatles' first albums, you know, as a kid, you hear the Beatles music and everything, and the cartoons you're watching, the movies you're watching, the commercials. But now, going back and looking at it from an artistic standpoint, I get a whole new, it's like hearing it for the first time all over again. Sinatra as well.
Is there anything specific that sort of blew you away with an older perspective, listening to like a Purple Rain or listening to Revolver or whatever, that sort of stood out? Wow, I can't believe this could be done.
Well, I think that, you know, just from knowing the time frames, again, when I got more into music and understanding the time periods and the eras in terms of recording and how to record sounds and how to mix and master. And the Beatles were obviously just way ahead of their time in terms of how they recorded, you know, even the basic engineering of what they were doing, which obviously was incredible. I think Frank's, you know, body of work stands for itself. The fact that he has 96 studio albums, I mean, that blew me away, obviously, was incredible. And Prince, you know, again, he the uniqueness of him and the weirdness of him definitely transcended over into his music, because he used sounds and riffs that you just wouldn't think would make hit songs, and they did.
Royce, is there a commonality in terms of how a certain creativity, whether it's in music or art, can transfer to basketball and an outlook on how a game can be organized and what a player should do on the floor and what he can do with the players around him? Is there a link between those two things?
Well, I think so. You know, being a player is anything you do on the court is just an extension of your imagination. And it happens a lot quicker, obviously, than writing a book, right? You have a lot of time to write it, rewrite it, and rewrite it again. As a player, you have to do it, you know, snap time. But I think the real creative players that you see, guys like Steve Nash and Kobe Bryant, you know, they imagine the game days, years, and months ahead of time, and they're really acting out things that they've already done a million times. And that's why the stuff looks so poetic sometimes.
So it's that improvisational, I guess, those improvisational instincts that come from just knowing everything so well, they can ad-lib.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, it's a creativity thing. I mean, when I'm playing, I feel like I see things ahead of time, but I also see things in a different way than I think most players see them. I see, like, all 10 guys moving as one big shape. Right. And I know where my guys are in that shape, and I know where their guys are in that shape, and I see where people are open and where there's slack in the defense. So, you know, I think when you get that creativity, it helps you be a better player, obviously, or at least a different kind of player.
When you talk about guys like that, and you know, you've mentioned guys who are with an odd outlook and difference and all that kind of, how difficult is it? And I think this is something that you probably understand as well as anybody, to go through life and to willingly make yourself different than other people.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the toughest things to do. And obviously I'm biased because I do it every day. right. But no, I mean, actively being different is tough, right? Because when you get down to it, you're lonely. And I think that that's something that I experience all the time, which is why I do so many things. I find, you know, the cure to the loneliness and the work and the creativity. And a lot of times my projects are my love, you know, are my friends. And that's what you have to do. Because, you know, when you're, I don't want to say ahead of your time, but, you know, when you do things different, you got a different outlook on life. It's going to be a lonely ride. But it's necessary. You know, you're going to have your guys that are ahead of their time, and you have your guys that are in their time, and guys that are still living in the past. And it's all necessary, but I think it is really difficult for sure.
On a personal level, how important is it for you and your health and your outlook to stay engaged in things like that, whether it's basketball, whether it's music, whether, you know, that kind of active creativity and active working of your mind?
Yeah, well, I think it's everything for me. I mean, I find that when I'm not doing something creative, you know, I can feel it, you know, physically. And that's the mental health, you know, that's the anxiety disorder, you know what I mean? With, you know, your average person, they probably wouldn't feel that physically. But I can because of the things that I deal with mental health wise. But, you know, it's everything to stay involved for me. I find it to be very helpful for me to find a path and stay ambitious on it and win, lose, or draw, just to pursue. Just the pursuit of it keeps me in a great place. And that's why I think I'll be successful in a lot of things. So I'm not really scared to fail because I'm just happy with the process and seeing if I can succeed or fail.
The last question I have for you, Royce, it's on a different topic altogether, but following you on Twitter the night of the Zimmerman verdict, your reaction to the news came out in, I thought, a very grounded, reasoned, thoughtful series of tweets, and it was much more about the bigger questions raised by the verdict than really off emotion that, you know, we saw a lot, you know, throughout cyberspace, and I think really anybody.
Right.
Was this purposeful on your part at all to, I guess, maybe try to maintain a sense of calm, you know, with your followers and stuff like that? But also, too, does it in any way reflect a change in your outlook in terms of how to use Twitter or how to just sort of address bigger issues in general?
Well, I mean, I think that Twitter, you know, I feel two ways about it. Obviously, if it was my call, right, Twitter wouldn't be as important as it is. I mean, that's just if it was my show, but it's not. And Twitter is just as important as it is. And if you're anybody who wants to have a social impact or do things that have to deal with the people, you can't ignore what the people pay attention to. And that's just being careless. It's being irresponsible with what you're trying to do. So I think, you know, it's become a good thing for people to try and discuss on Twitter. Right. And we're in a place where discussions need to happen all over the place. Right. The Zimmerman verdict was a point of discussion. But there's so many more discussions that need to be had. And that's kind of what I tried to say on Twitter is that I always used to hear from one of my old coaches that nothing's ever as bad as you think and nothing's ever as good as you think. That's really hard to hear when you have a death, especially of a teenage boy, which is really tragic. But, you know, the reality is that what we did as a people to get to that point is what we have to look at, or else we're going to get to that point again. And obviously gun control is something that comes into play, and urban communities is something that comes into play, and violence, and a whole number of other things, economics, you know, there's a number of things that come into play that I think you have to have a discussion about. Or else you're doing, you know, Trayvon a disservice. You're doing the next Trayvon Martin a disservice. So that's kind of what I tried to say.
My last question for you, Royce. If you listen to Kobe, he'll talk all the time, you know, the sort of the legend of Kobe and the work ethic and all these other things. But he describes himself often as, you know, sort of pathological in the way that he trains, in the way that he's motivated, in the way that he's competitive. he'll use terms like that. And I never would ever ask you to diagnose somebody. It's not fair or responsible. But when you look at people, whether it's Kobe and that kind of hyper competitiveness, or other people generally, you know, artists and people who are, you know, outside, you know, have some personality attribute that's outside the norm. How do you explain to people the difference between something like that, that's just maybe just an extreme version of quote unquote normal, and something that is a disorder, if that makes sense?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the tough thing that we have to deal with is that there may not be a difference. And I think in the mental health community, and obviously confidentiality is a huge piece in why there's such a disconnection between what we know about people who deal with mental health disorders or who we know deals with them, right? You know, because of the stigma, and people don't want people to know, therefore they don't know because they have that right to their privacy. But I think if you just opened up the book, right, and could see everybody who deals with mental health disorders, you would see a lot of people that are highly successful, like Kobe Bryant. And just from, I mean, I went to Nike camps as a high school prospect, and you know, I heard stories of Kobe Bryant working out until he blacks out. Right. And that definitely, again, you know, don't want to try and diagnose Kobe Bryant, but that definitely sounds like, you know, symptoms or traces of an OCD, mm-hmm. right? And just a straight obsession with the game or with success or with being better or whatever the idea is in his head that he wants, he's obsessed with getting it. And that doesn't have to be a bad thing. It can be a dangerous thing, obviously, if you're blacking out. But, you know, if he can do it, he can do it, right? But I use myself more when I talk about being hyper-competitive. When I first started music, I remember there was a place called Uptown in Minneapolis, and my friend had a studio there, and I stayed there for – this is right when I left the University of Minnesota and took that time off. I stayed there for 6 weeks straight in a room that had no windows. When it gets dark in there at nighttime, you can't tell what time of day it is in there. And I was there for 6 weeks straight, and I probably lost like 25 pounds, 20, 26, 27 pounds. I wasn't eating normally, but I was happy. I was happy because I was fine-tuning my ability to produce something that I love, which is music. And, you know, and the crazy thing is I saw my doctor. Crazy, I probably shouldn't use that word, but the ironic thing is that I saw my family practitioner who first diagnosed me with anxiety, and she said, like, during that six-week period that was the best that I've ever looked, you know, in terms of color, my face, and my attention, and how I was acting with my anxiety, because obviously she can pick up on things just from how you're acting physically. She said it was like the best I've ever looked, which is really weird because you would think that 6 weeks in a studio with no food and irregular sleep, you would be you'd look terrible, right? But that's just not the way the brain works. You know, the brain is a very complex thing. It's the most complex organ in the body. So
one man's obsessive can be another man's healthy, and that's what makes it so complicated to get a beat on.
Right, and one thing that makes somebody healthy can make somebody else could kill somebody else. Right. I mean, it's, you know, some people obsess about things and it kills them with drugs. Right. I mean, that's, you know, I mean, it can be fatal. That's why you have to pay attention to it. And the first thing is you have to pay attention. And then the second thing is you have to genuinely care enough to say that you're going to get the right kind of support. And then next, you have to know that it's very individual based and you're not going to be able to write up a blueprint and say this is how we should do it for everybody, because that's going to be irresponsible and you're just going to end up doing somebody a disservice.
Well, it's a really cool topic, and there's obviously a lot of ways we can go here, and maybe we'll have a chance to do this again. But Royce White, forward, Philadelphia 76ers, looking forward to getting you on the floor this year. Thanks so much for the time. We really appreciate it.
I appreciate you guys, man. Thanks for having me.